Session number 13653, reel number 3.
Mr. Brain, reel 3.
This mission sortie was to report if a German railway gun was still housed in a very long railway tunnel at a place called Saint-André-d'Herbeteau.
Can you spell it?
Yes.
Spell it out.
D apostrophe H-E-B-E-R-T-O-T.
We know that's the correct spelling because you've got some railway tickets.
Yes.
That you can quote from.
I traced this tunnel on my map and I went down to the company of Paris who were in the district and very quickly got a couple of volunteers who said if I went into the tunnel they would give me covering fire. So we drove to the little shattered railway station on this single line railway and I started to walk towards the tunnel, leaving the two soldiers at the station, and suddenly somebody from the wooded slopes of the valley through which the railway ran, somebody fired at me. I'm glad to say they weren't very good shots, but the shots crackled around my feet, so I burst into a run and about 200 yards got into the entrance of this tunnel. I should have been a sitting duck if there had been German soldiers in the tunnel, but fortunately they weren't, and although it was nearly 2 miles away, I could see a tiny chink of light which confirmed that there was no railway gun left there. I then beat a hasty retreat back to the station to the two Paras who were covering my run, and I remember trying to run as fast as possible upon French sleepers. But unlike British sleepers, which are regular in size and pattern and distance, French sleepers seem to be made from any old bit of tree cut down, and they were any old shape. And they were most difficult things to run upon if you were in a hurry, and I was, just in case this sniper, whoever he was still around. But at the station, I picked up these tickets. Do you want?
The railway tickets.
Yes, I picked up this packet of railway tickets just as a souvenir. And I was able to report when I got back to my set that the tunnel was clear of enemy troops. But the railway gun had been a source of considerable embarrassment, apparently, to the beaches in Normandy, over which, for a long time after the closing of the gap at Falaise, all our supplies had to come. When I got back out of the range of sniper fire, I was met by a very tall, elegant-looking Frenchman who told me that he was the captain in charge of the FFI, the...
That's the Gaullist resistance
program. That's right, yes. The Armée Française de Libération.
Force Française de l'Intérieur.
Yes. He gave me the details of the gun and the strength of the unit that had been manning this gun and that they had fired for some 19 days before withdrawing. This information I also passed back to Canadian Army Headquarters. On the 31st of August, I was ordered back to the 1st Polish Armoured Division, and they were already on the move eastwards. They crossed the Somme, and for several nights we stayed in the names of villages and towns familiar to me from what I had heard of World War I. We liberated Poperinghe, and I was invited by one of the local citizens to go and see the famous Talbot House, which had been a German billet, and there were still remains of the German meal on the table there, because their soldiers had left rather hurriedly. The trouble with all these places that we liberated in France and Belgium was they all wanted you to stop and drink champagne with them, champagne and brandy that they had kept throughout the occupation. But unfortunately, one couldn't indulge on those occasions. And we moved forward through Ypres, where I was the first British officer to reach the Menin Gate on the liberation. And one interesting thing was that east of the Menin Gate, there were enormous cemeteries. On the right-hand side, a vast British cemetery where the graves and the flowers had been tended by the inhabitants of Ypres throughout the occupation. The German cemetery on the left-hand side of the road was thoroughly overgrown in every respect, and this was a silent way in which the Belgian people showed their disapproval of the Germans. Finally, we reached Passchendaele, another night where it was interesting to see rusty wire and what was left of the trenches of World War I. And then we moved on, because by this time we had news of the Guards Armour Division bursting into Brussels, and so the Germans were obviously in complete retreat. The Brussels was fully liberated on the 4th of September, and the Polish Armour Division moved into Ghent on the 6th. It was a Sunday, and it was most pleasing to hear the bells of the famous Carillon, isn't it? Yes, that's right. In the cathedral there, we're playing familiar English hymn tunes. And, of course, the whole of the city was en fait. But again, one couldn't stop to celebrate with them. On the 12th of September, the port of Le Havre was captured, and this was a great relief to all thinking soldiers, because until this point in time, everything that the growing Allied armies needed, from fresh water to ammunition to food to everything that you could think of, had to come in over the beaches of Normandy. And by capturing Le Havre, we had at last a reasonable port. On the 7th of October, I was promoted to the rank of acting captain, for the simple reason that the British Army said that a phantom officer as a full lieutenant was not senior enough to hold his position in headquarters, and therefore a captain would have greater authority and would be respected somewhat more. At this time, on the 10th of October, squadron headquarters moved to Antwerp, and very shortly afterwards the Germans started bombing Antwerp with V2s. I was driving through on one occasion, and we passed a British military policeman at the main crossroads, and some way back in the convoy there was a lorry load of WAFs, Women Air Force.
WAFs.
Well, that's right, WAFs. The V2 fell smack bang on the military policeman, and not enough of him was discovered to bury, and a lot of the WAFs were killed in this lorry. This was a lucky escape as far as my unit was concerned, because we had passed this military policeman, and I doubt if we were 200 yards away from him at the time. About this time, I was ordered to 12 Corps as a link with the Canadian Army, and 12 Corps were in Nijmegen. The attack on the bridges at Arnhem had failed, and we were still trying to exploit our the land that we had seized either side of the main road to Nijmegen. Breda fell to the Poles on the 29th of October.
Do you have any memories of Breda?
Yes, I do. I was there on and off for most of the winter months because the Polish Armoured Division couldn't operate on the frozen ground and frozen roads, and therefore they were in a holding position on the line of the River Maas. And there they stayed until the spring weather, when they were used to cross the Rhine and burst into the North German plain. But I was not left in Breda with them very long. I was sent down on the 16th of December. I was kept awake all night by my control unit, and finally we got what we called an orange uncle, operationally urgent message, ordering us to move to Givet down in the Ardennes at first light. This was a really fearful journey because although my dispatch riders and my vehicles kept on the roads, they were sheet ice all the way, and we ran into vast American convoys, mainly driven by colored soldiers. And these chaps were driving through the night with flaming headlights, full on. It was a fortunate thing that at that time the German Air Force was grounded by the weather, because they would have been sitting targets. But finally we got through to Givet on the morning of the 17th of December, and when I went into the town, I looked for the local American unit to report to, and there were no American soldiers of any kind. And the leading elements of the German Panzer Army were at Bastogne, which is not very many kilometers to the east of Givet. Givet being on the western side of the Maas.
Yes, I think it is the Maas.
I think it is.
Unless it's the Sambre.
No, it's the Maas, I'm pretty sure, but one's memory really takes a pasting. Anyway, I reported to the sergeant in charge of this American military police unit, and he said, "I'm glad to see you, Limers. We understood you were coming. How many troops have you got?" When I told him I had 8, his face was a picture, because he too knew, as I did, that the German panzers were quite close and heading for Givet and its bridges. Meanwhile, a unit of the Royal Engineers had come in and mined the bridges in the Givet district, this would not have held up the German army very long, because they had paratroops ready to seize a bridgehead on the western side. As the world now knows, the Germans ran out of petrol. They never captured the American supplies of petrol that they expected. And when we did venture forth eastwards to see if we could find out where the Germans were, we came across several Tiger tanks abandoned in the middle of the road, simply because they had run out of petrol. When the German armoured thrust failed, I was ordered back to regimental headquarters, then located on the field of the site of the Battle of Waterloo. And I was there on Christmas Eve, 1944, when I had an hour or two off, and I went shopping. And in W.H. Smith & Sons, apparently they hadn't seen an Allied officer for some time. A lot of the girls came around me to inquire if I knew how the German attack what was going, because they were terribly worried and security clamped down on this, and they could remember the occupation of Brussels at the beginning of the war. And I was able to tell them that the German attack had failed and they were withdrawing. And I was nearly carried shoulder high out of W.H. Smith's shop in Brussels. But I was not sorry, actually, to leave Givet, because we had some very unpleasant accommodation there, and we had to work with some cloak and dagger chaps from the French army who carried daggers in their gaiters and both legs. And these chaps, so I gathered from their officer, had been released from Devil's Island to come and kill Germans. I was then sent to 1st American Army headquarters, where we had reasonably comfortable accommodation in an old military barracks, and we were in the police cells. And one morning there, I'd only just come off watch with the radio sets and marking the map, giving information into the staff of the army headquarters, when I had gone to bed and I'd been asleep about an hour, when I was rudely woken by one of my men. "Sir, Field Marshal Montgomery wants to see you." My reply was rather rude. I said, "I'm not in the mood for jokes at 7 o'clock in the morning. I can't believe even the bloody Field Marshal is going to be going the rounds at that time of the day." He said, "Sir, please hurry quick. He's out there. He's asked for you personally." I said, "He doesn't know me from a hole in the road." Anyway, I threw off my uniform best I could, and there, sure enough, in the little square outside of this barracks, sat the Field Marshal with the door open, ready to give the first person who would accept them 1,000 cigarettes, even though he was very anti-smoking. The first thing he said to me was, "Do your men smoke?" And they smoked like chimneys, so I got 1,000 cigarettes for them. But then he wanted to know what the latest position was, and do you know, when you've been at it for about 24 hours and you suddenly go to sleep, your mind is a complete blank. And I had to admit it, that if he would wait 10 minutes, I'd be happy to get him the latest picture, but I hadn't a clue. And with that, he asked me the name of the next Phantom officer with the American 9th Army, which I was able to tell him. And then I realized how it was that he discovered my name from the previous Phantom officer he'd called upon.
Where was this?
This was at Spa, which is on the banks of the... The river is the...
Don't worry about the river.
This is the Maas, I'm sure, down there. Now then, driving down on Christmas morning to Spa, there was a long, straight road, and not a vehicle upon it. And suddenly a Messerschmitt appeared, and he was intrigued because my armoured car had a damn great Union Jack fluttering from one of the mudguards, and I think he thought that he'd probably got the CNC of the 21st Army Group, particularly as I was accompanied by dispatch riders. And he toyed with me by flying over me low and turning round and coming back again time and time again. Each time I imagined that he would rake me with his machine guns. I'm very glad to be able to report that he flew away in the end, having decided that we weren't worthy of his ammunition, or because it was Christmas morning and he felt a Christian charity. We arrived at Spa. And that evening, I went into the large hall that passed us for an officer's mess. And we'd hardly sat down when, I think it was probably a V1 or V2 exploded just outside the building. And one wall came in over a lot of, and lots of glass came in all over the tables, and we were in darkness. And for the first time in my life, I ate my Christmas dinner, tinned turkey, smothered in maple syrup, as the Americans like it. And I had to do it in the dark by feeling the pieces of turkey meat and deciding that some of the harder bits were probably plaster or pieces of glass. But it was a Christmas dinner I shall never forget. I didn't want that. With the coming of spring, we knew in Phantom that we should cross that the Allies would cross the Rhine on the 23rd of March. And we were keyed up for this day, and for at least 10 days before, Allied guns pounded the eastern bank, and all the towns, Emmerich and so on, that were on the opposite side with everything they had, including not only shells but also rockets. And this racket went on for a very long time. What it was like at the receiving end, I don't know, because it was bad enough at the giving end, giving side. But about this time, I was called in to the squadron commander and told that they wanted me to take my patrol and land across the Rhine with the American 81st Airborne Division. Well, as I've said previously, I much prefer to deal with Germans on my two feet and not jumping out of an aircraft, but this would have been in a glider. Fortunately, from my standpoint anyway, the attack by that division was called off, and instead I was sent to the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division, with whom I crossed the River Rhine. From then on, I was with the Polish Armored Division. I was returned, I should say, not because I went across the Rhine with the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division. I can tell you a lot of my interesting things, but I won't bother about that. But I would like to say that I was then transferred to the Polish Armored Division, with whom I served whenever they were on active service. 3 times before the Rhine crossing, I was sent to Goes, G-O-E-S, in South Beveland, to cross to Schoen Island, S-C-H-O-W-E-N, which was held by the Germans. But 3 times the attack was called off because of thick fog. They were a remarkable lot, number 44 Royal Marine Commando, because they would have a party before going into action, and a lot of them had quite a lot to drink the night before and were playing high cockalorum in the hotel bar that passed for an officer's mess. And yet, within a couple of hours, before dawn, they were ready to assemble to cross the short stretch of seawater. Full stop. I eventually returned to the Polish Armored Division, and on the way we passed a concentration camp. We passed this concentration camp at Aschendorf, where I saw for the first time a concentration camp before it had been tidied up in any way, and the heaps of dead and those who were crawling and only just living. And in the women's section of this camp, which was devoted almost entirely to Polish women, one of the Polish officers found his sister, an emaciated skeleton. Whilst I was in the camp, the Polish Armored Corps officers held a sort of impromptu court-martial, and the inmates were asked to pick out the guards who had been unkind to them and those who'd been reasonable. And those who were picked out as having been brutal were pushed over across against a wall and machine gun, summarily executed. And the others looked to be rather happy and went cheerfully into a prisoner of war camp because their lives had been saved.
About how many were executed?
I would think 11 or 12.
And how many were saved?
At least the same number. Some had escaped, so we didn't see the whole situation, the whole staff. But there were many scenes in this camp that I shall never forget. In the Allies had shelled the camp and shattered the wire, and one of the inmates tried to escape. And he had got into a shell hole near the gap in the wire round the camp, and the warders at this dreadful place had poured kerosene on him and set fire to it. And in his wounded condition, he'd been hit by shrapnel, he died a very unpleasant death. Now,